I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
My next guest is a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter who shot to stardom with the silky smash hit Like a Star, which was followed by an eponymous debut album that sold 4 million copies. Over the course of her career, she's released 3 critically acclaimed albums, earned 2 Grammy Awards, 2 MOBOs, and been nominated for countless others. This month, she made a comeback with her years-in-the-making art record, Black Rainbows, a musical project featuring songs, a book, live performances, visuals, lectures, and exhibitions. You name it. Let's take a listen.
New York Transit Queen, New York Transit Queen, New York Transit Queen, little over 17.
Stirring stuff. Well, earlier I caught up with Corinne and asked why she chose to create this multi-dimensional project.
I just felt like the record wasn't enough to contain all of these stories. I first went to Stony Island Arts Bank in 2017 and I walked through the doors of this Gothic bank from the 1920s. And I was just amazed at what I saw, this huge volume of black literature, more than 16,000 books that had been submitted to the Ebony and Jet magazine makers, the Johnson family. And they are on this range of block subjects from everything from Ethiopia, Egypt, you know, the black pioneers going west, mask, dance since the 15th century, you know, autobiographies, yearbooks, recipe books, just everything. And then on the next floor up, you go through these drawers and cabinets and unwrap and things wrapped in tissue paper. And it's magazine articles, it's newspaper articles from the 1850s, it's they're kind of trinkets and problematic objects from America's past. There's postcards, there's photographs, there's
what was it that you found so engaging? I mean, obviously it's centuries of black history. Was that something that you hadn't really encountered until that moment? Because obviously as a woman and then as a black woman, you know, there is a sense that a lot of one's past isn't where it should be.
Absolutely. So I felt like in my search for lots of information and answers on a variety of things around sort of black diaspora and history, I might have met at my school or even at university or even in bookshops, I might have felt like I'd reached the limit of the information that there was available. So I might say, oh, I'd really love to see photographs of this or that, or know more about the all black towns of the West. And then people would say, oh, that's just not documented. Oh, there isn't evidence of that. Oh,
it's
that
an oral
might be
history.
Mythical. I'm not sure. Yeah, it's oral. Exactly. It's oral history. It's hidden. But actually, it turns out this history is not hidden, that it's silenced and erased. But there are places that have records of so many documents, so many newspaper articles, so many adverts from the 1950s, family photographs, so much that kind of documents and fills in some answers for me. And it's all done in this most beautiful way. I was saying before, when I might have looked on black literature and subjects, I might go to a library in Leeds and it might be the sort of place where people are going to get a prescription, and they're also might be going to get the housing benefit, and there might also be some posters about, I don't know, getting injections or... But here it's in this beautiful sort of elevated art space, you know, this double height library where it's all been brought together by this visual artist, the Astor Gates. You know, there's sound suits from Nick Cave, the artist, on the walls. There are various exhibitions happening in and out of the building. So it's
so
just
it feels it's, like
it's
a,
black
an act
history
of celebration.
In this kind of in this elevated and academic way, which I haven't been around before. And when I was in there with the Astor in this building, it's kind of cathedral to black art. When I was in there, he said, oh, you should do a concert in here. But when I left, all I felt was that these stories, these various stories of people who were looking out photographs at me or newspaper articles or objects, I felt like they were telling me their story. And it was kind of, it was my obsession to fill in those stories, to respond to them, to tell them.
And did it feel like that when you were actually writing the songs for the album as well? I mean, did you feel like a sort of cipher for other people's stories?
Absolutely. It was such a pleasure for me because so much of my work to date has been about my own experience. You know, mostly when I'm talking about an album, it's these are my thoughts, my feelings, my experiences. You know, and people always think it's pages pulled from a diary. And so, but this was so different because I was able to look at a photograph of a, you know, there's this brilliant woman, Audrey Smaltz, who's won this beauty competition. And she's 17 years old and she's hanging off the back of this fire truck with this cheeky expression on her face. And I could think, you know, who is she? What's this competition? I dug deeper into it and found it was a beauty competition. It was an all black competition because its equivalent, Miss Subways, wasn't open to black women in the 50s in America, in New York. So there's these amazing young women who are winning this beauty competition, but Audrey Smaltz is an artist. She took her art book with her and showed her drawings. That's how she won. And I just thought, who is this rebel raiser, you know, this hell raiser? And I was able to meet her. You know, she's in her 80s now. She's had this incredible life and traveled all around the world. She was on Wall Street. She was Mrs. Johnson's right-hand woman when they would fly to Paris and get couture and bring it back to America and introduce it to these all these different African-American sort of local buildings in the Ebony Fashion Fair. So I think it was important for me to make sure these stories were known, and it was nice for me to be able to get out of the way. It felt like I was getting out of the way and they were just sort of chattering in the background and all I had to do was kind of sing it out.
It's interesting you say that. I was talking to a travel writer the other day, Lois Price, and she was talking about how each of her books is a sort of an evolution in terms of, you know, who she's becoming as she grows older. And, you know, her first one was all about me going on this trip, Lois Unleashed, you know. And then the next book was actually looking beyond herself at what was around her and so on and so forth. I wonder if the same thing happens when you make albums, that each one is a snapshot in a way of who you are at that moment in time.
They really are. I mean, that's why I call them, they're a record, right? They're sort of a record of that particular moment. And when I was making this album, I always thought of it as a side project. I thought, this is the way I can be the most free. It's not going to be my record. It's not going to be my name. It's going to be a side project called Black Rainbows. And that meant that I was able to really dream and paint with this wider range of colours, you know, to be on this rainbow-like spectrum. So I was able to bring punk and I was able to bring, you know, Afrofuturist music and or piano ballads and sing in an operatic style or sing a 1950s song and be all enunciating like Eartha Kitt. And I wanted to be able to bring all this forth. And I thought, well, I don't have to then think about, is this a catchy chorus? Is this going to get played on the radio? And so that's why one of the songs is less than 2 minutes and another song is almost 9 minutes and they're rangy, you know, and it was only really when I saw the artwork and saw my name was on it and thought, actually, it makes sense, that I was able to then own and say, this is my record, but it's not my own stories there, but then it's my lens, right? It's my brain. So it's how these tales have impacted me. They've kind of gone into my mind and come back out. So, you know, they always say you can never get very far away from yourself. But I feel like my own interests and obsessions have led my research. I am interested in women. I'm interested in young women. I'm interested in young people. I'm interested in black people and these silenced and hidden stories. You know, when I came across this book, Hard Art, and it's all these young black kids digging this really hard rock music in Washington DC in the 1970s, I just think, oh, I've never seen photographs like this of, you know, the band Bad Brains playing and seeing like a 7-year-old girl on the front row just with this massive gleeful expression, a young black girl. If we don't share stories wider, we don't see ourselves reflected in culture, it does narrow and make our world smaller. And I think when I was in my indie band, I didn't see loads of photos of, you know, black people in rock music. And I definitely didn't see loads of photos of a black audience in Glee. at this kind of spitty, shouty punk.
And, I mean, there's a big contrast, isn't there, to growing up in Leeds and going to an amazing state-of-the-art museum celebrating everything about black culture, which obviously wouldn't have existed 50 years ago, you know, probably only built in the last 20, I imagine. How much did you feel on an emotional level that you'd somehow missed out on part of everything to do with who you were?
I think, I feel like I'm lucky to be from Leeds. You know, Leeds has a big Caribbean community, and Leeds has the biggest publisher of Caribbean literature outside of the Caribbean. It has People Tree Press, and it has the Carnival, which is the oldest West Indian carnival in Europe. So it had these touchstones of sort of blackness and celebrating black history. So I felt like I was able to grow up around this black diaspora and music and culture and food, but definitely in terms of loads and loads of objects and loads of evidence of the historic black stories, there was so much more in Chicago. There was so much more. You know, Chicago is such a huge center of black life because so many people from the South came up to Chicago. It's the biggest internal migration that's ever happened in the US.
Do you feel that, I mean, I just wonder if you feel that in this country, I mean, you've always been involved in jazz, which obviously is black music to start with. And but do you feel that somehow in this country we're not moving as fast as America? I mean, I know that you've been hugely embraced in the US. You've performed at the White House. Michelle Obama had you on her playlist. I mean, there can be no greater compliment, can there? So is there a sense as well that this is a whole new world out there that actually we've got to catch up with in this country? Because you've always been, you know, reasonably politicized in your career and in your opinions. And it feels like there's this Damascene thing going on. But it's in very much in contrast as well. I mean, you know, we could make the mistake of making America sound like it's a brilliant, you know, in venerating black culture. But actually, at the same time, movements like Black Lives Matter exist for a reason. So there's two very different Americas existing there, aren't there?
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There are two different Americas, and that was the most fascinating thing, I think, about the Arts Bank. You know, going through every copy of Ebony magazine that's been made is in the Arts Bank, and they've been leather-bound and gold-embossed. They're being held up as great literature, and so you go through these tomes on Black culture, and you find stories that were, I guess, that have been perceived as being hidden stories. I think of that film Hidden Figures about the Black women that were at NASA, which I remember when it came out, and it seemed to people as though, is this revisionist history? What is this? But it was just looking at the Black women who factually and actually worked at NASA in the 50s and 60s. But of course, if you open a copy of Ebony magazine from that time, we find interviews with these women. We find photographs of these women. We find quotes from them. So you're right in saying it's two different Americas. Black people in America knew that this story was happening. But for whatever reason, for all the reasons we know about, those people's stories weren't part of this, then part of the school curriculum, then part of wider popular culture, weren't in Life magazine, for example, and didn't go, the stories didn't go further and wider. So I think what's happening now is there's been more attention paid to Black stories. But I think amongst Black people themselves, this information has been carried, whether it's been carried through photos or stories or orally or through songs, or that those stories have remained intact. And I think there's just now there's so much more time and intention to look at them. But I think another thing that happens in America is that there are private individuals who put in their money. There's still a kind of what we had in the UK in the Victorian era. You know, we have a building near us, the salt mill, Titus Salt, the industrialist, wants to get into heaven and wants to show himself to be a refined man. So he invests heavily in the arts. I think we have moved away from that in this country, and we want and expect and hope that the government will be the sort of holder of these important archives. But of course, we've seen from even what happened with Windrush, not only are they not the holder and treasurer of Black archives, but they're losing important information. You know, sometimes the passports and paperwork of the people who live here came here from the Caribbean. So I think, ironically, sometimes if the government has less of an interest like it has in America, there's still that philanthropic alignment where wealthy individuals want to be adjacent to culture to embolden themselves, like a Ford Foundation or all of those those industrialists. Their time is nearer and their work seems to be in art, you know. Or you think of the Prada Foundation in Italy, you know, lots of individual foundations are doing more than governments. They probably have more money, and we sort of have to look to them and continue to encourage people with wealth to reinvest.
I think your dad is from St. Kitts, is he
yes,
not?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So did you feel personally invested when that whole Windrush scandal emerged and the extent to which those people who'd moved here with, you know, the promise of all kinds of things, how much did that impact on you emotionally? Because we can look at it and see it as a total injustice, but perhaps the emotional engagement is different.
Yeah, I really felt the connection with that you could have this invitation from your mother country. You know, so many of the Caribbeans felt themselves to be more British than the British. You know, in their geography lessons, they would learn about the rivers of England. You know, they were looking forward to coming and having crumpets and toast. And I think, but a passport itself is such a flimsy and ephemeral thing. You know, I remember when my dad sent back his passport, you know, with a photograph in of when he was 14, he sent his passport to get upgraded, and the old passport never came back. But that passport to us was kind of a link to him coming from St. Kitts. You know, it had the stamp in and it had the little photograph of him when he was a kid. And now we know how those records were held. But I think, you know, to think of people's grandparents who came as a child, you know, and with a cardigan on, you know, they didn't even own a coat, and they'd grown up and worked here. To sort of go to a family wedding in Jamaica and then find you can't get back in because there's no record that you've lived there. I mean, it just must have been terrifying for people, or people being turned down for cancer treatment. And you realise, yeah, there hasn't been. And then, you know, Priti Patel's comment about a culture of grievance, you know, as though there's a Caribbean, the Caribbeans are kind of just making a fuss about nothing and should kind of keep it to themselves. You know, I thought that was so telling, and so telling of, you know, unfortunately our government seems to be so detached from the everyday people, the working people, so much disinterest in the poorest people, a lot of blame about how people end up where they do, and not, instead of thinking that so much about the wealth in this country is hereditary. And so, yeah, I mean, America and the UK are impossible to compare places, but yeah, there seems to be if we're relying on the government to support the arts, we will maybe be disappointed here.
I'm fascinated by the fact that as your life has become, you know, settled, you know, you've got two daughters, you've got your husband, who you also work with as a musician from time to time, and all of those things, that rather than explore that part of your life, it seems to have given you a platform to like just open up completely to everything else. Is that what it feels like, that sort of security, that bedrock of family allows you to be freer almost?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, having those questions answered, I mean, for me, having a family and having a partner is so, it's a double blessing for me because, you know, you, as you probably know, it was when I lost my first husband in 2008, when I was 29, he was 31. And that really felt to me like the end of my life. And I sort of assessed my life from that point and thought, well, I've had a really good life. You know, I've had this happy childhood and I've had this career and I've had this success. And it sort of felt now there's nothing else to do. So sort of watch the clock, you know, and I felt terrified of the future because I thought it just seemed like a wasteland. And then as time went by, to be able to see these sort of shoots coming here and coming there and to be able to, you know, come back, incredible friends around me and family, and then even to find a romance. And then, you know, I thought, I'm 29, I'll never be able to have children because how would I even meet someone in time to then have, you know, I was really lucky. And I had my kids in my late 30s and early 40s. And that, again, was something you can't sort of guarantee. And so I feel incredibly lucky to have this thing that I wanted, this to be in the place where I wanted. And we do all travel around the world together as a kind of traveling circus. And, you know, my mum comes too. And so I feel this big sense of kind of maturity and experience and like you say, stability to then be able to artistically take more risks and be more free and think, you know, what if I allow my interests and obsessions, you know, my interest in this weird building and all this weird stuff and this diaspora and history, you know, can I really write a song about the rock churches of Lalibela in Ethiopia? Yes, and I'm going to, and here it is, you know. So I feel, and also encountering artists, you know, namely Theaster Gates, whose practice is so diverse, everything from reclaiming buildings that the government's going to tear down, you know, saving a school, to making things out of massive things out of clay, to you know, everything he does is an artwork. He did a whole exhibition where I think a friend of his had passed away, and so he cut up all of his clothes, every suit, every t-shirt, and made them into these sort of winds. I think these kind of scarf neckties, and that was his art. You know, so just to have someone who thinks everything you make, everything you do is making, and all your creativity can go across every aspect of your life. That's really spoken to me. That's been the thing in the building that's transformed the way I think about making stuff and making music.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.